There you go, a bit of Paul McCartney and Wings for you. That was 1984 or 5, I can't remember actually, but who cares. Tony Gosling, not satisfied with having his own show on Friday, wants to come in and steal a bit of my airtime.
Yeah, only because you did it to me.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. I was a guest on your show.
I'm now a guest on yours, so okay. There.
Anyway, I don't want to say, pretend you're not welcome. You're perfectly welcome.
Oh, thank you so much. You came on my show, didn't you, to talk about microwaves and how you have no problem with your...
Mobile phone. It's in my pocket here.
No, the Wi-Fi.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because I think, there's some evidence that this does affect particularly kids. Mobile phones, the waves from mobile phones can penetrate through the skull of a child very easily.
Yeah, but that's
and
the whole point.
Do they do any damage? You know, I think
there's no evidence that they do.
Well, there is a lot of evidence. No, there's not. It's very weak evidence. There is. You talked to Roger Coghill. He's one of the go onto your favourite search engine, put in Roger Coghill. He's a professor. He used to work for the military on microwave research, and he will tell you that this is actually very dangerous stuff. And the reason that it's all being pushed is because the government is now totally dependent on the licence fees they charge to operate mobile phone networks to the mobile companies. And if those mobile phone networks were closed down, I mean, obviously it would affect our lives a lot for safety reasons and health reasons, then the government would go like Greece basically overnight. So,
well, yeah, I still think that you may be right. The important point is that the danger, if there is a danger, the danger is from the phones themselves, not the masks, because the dose of radiation you get from the phone is, a million times greater than the
mask. All these masks have gone up in strength and power because everyone wants to watch the TV now on their phones. Mm-hmm. And so if you did have a mask, I mean, what annoys me is when they put them on top of schools, on top of tower blocks. If you're living on the top floor of a tower block, you've got one of these blasted things right above your head constantly. I know in Ireland, Northern Ireland, one of the things the IRA would do, and this is this terrorist type people, the gangster type IRA people, was take angle grinders and take down the mobile phone masks.
Right.
Because they were going through the official processes to try and get these things removed, believing that they were a real serious health risk.
Yeah.
And nothing would happen. The mobile phone masks would stay there, so they would go up on the roof with their angle grinder, rather like you go up on the roof at Barton Hill and sort our transmitter out when
it
needs doing.
Yeah. But anyway, well, we'll save that one for another day. It will run and run, but I'm pretty relaxed about it.
I like
it
to reopen these old wounds,
well, it's not an old wound. You see, I mean, I work in that area. You know, I understand radiation, and this is the key word, radiation, because people confuse ionizing radiation, which definitely does give you cancer, with non-ionizing radiation, i.e. radio waves. But anyway.
Microwaves are not radio waves, as you well know.
No, they absolutely are radio waves.
No, they're high frequency, much higher energy than
radio waves. They are radio waves. They are absolutely 100% radio waves. There is no distinction.
So nuclear, what do you call it, gamma radiation, they are radio waves?
They are indeed, yeah.
Well, you take a dose of gamma radiation and tell me if you feel okay.
Yeah? I wouldn't want to. We know that does cause cancer, but that's ionising radiation. It's still a radio wave. Anyway, we're going to change the subject completely and talk about transport, which is something else I know a little bit about.
Well, I think the other reason to raise this, Steve, is, I mean, we do talk about this on the Friday show between 5 and 7 from time to time, but, it's to go a little bit more in depth, because we've got a very serious situation developing with the cab drivers in Bristol, particularly the blue cabs, and their exclusion from Temple Meads.
So the deal, what's happened? What's changed recently?
Well,
then?
First group, our good old buddies, who some would call the biggest racket in town, but
You might say that, I couldn't possibly comment.
They are imposing £200 or £400 annual fee on all the blue cab drivers that want to apply for customers at Temple Meads station. Now, certainly for the last, since Brunel built it, a couple of hundred years ago, taxis have been able to pull up to Temple Meads without being charged to do so, to take customers home. This being basically public transport, seeing as a public service. I don't know what your thoughts are, whether taxis are public transport.
Well, they undoubtedly are. I'm just wondering whether the legality of this, because I'm guessing that Temple Meads itself is owned by Network Rail, is that right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and presumably then they lease it to First Great Western to run it.
But they've obviously had a good look at it and see, well, we're actually leasing these cobblestones that the cabs are coming round, and and the people who are individuals who are coming to pick up their family members at Temple Meads as well. So why don't we just charge people for coming on those cobblestones?
I'm just wondering whether there's some historic right better way that's been established.
Well, this is also, this is one of the things that the blue cab drivers and their groups are organising at the moment, is to actually check that out to see. And as I, my a little bird tells me that there may be an injunction slapped on First Group at any time by Bristol cab drivers to say, you know, basically we're not going to be paying this charge. The reason that I, the reason that they're worried about it is because they've seen internal documents from First Group that show and certainly indicate that whilst the first year they're being, every single blue cab driver is being asked to pay a few hundred pounds, that this is over increments over future years going to go up to £2,000 a year.
Wow.
For every single blue cab driver. Now they are all already in a very difficult situation, as you know, what with the financial situation, less people are taking cabs, more people getting the bus, more people walking home from the station where they might have, I mean, most of the people that use taxis, I'm guessing here a little, but I would say that they probably on expense accounts, most of the people that are just, they're just charging that to their company.
I'm sure that's quite often the case. I think there are those people who can afford it, who just get in the habit of using a cab because it's convenient. Just to pick up one detail, when you talk about blue cabs, that's the sort of why is it, they have a blue badge with their license?
The Hackney carriages, which are different to the private hire cabs. If you phone up to get a cab to come to your house or whatever, then to take you somewhere or pick you up, it's a whole different ball game legally than the Hackney carriages who ply for traffic on the streets. So they are the ones that have been being hit most, it seems, by the recession. Less people actually using the cabs. And, of course, you know, they are in a very difficult situation. Many of these, I mean, I've spoken to some of the cab drivers about this, and they're saying that actually a lot of cabbies are now having to use their credit cards to pay the rent. And, you know, basically they're not making anywhere near enough money coming in to pay the various fees. This fee by First Group just being another like nail in the coffin for many of these people's livelihoods.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is just one aspect of transport in the city, but I think it is indicative of the way things are going, where we have a sort of, you know, racket monopoly system where people can get away with almost anything if they've got the legal. I mean, the cabbies have gone straight away to Bristol City Council, of course, saying to them, you know, can't you do anything to stop this, because this is going to be driving loads of people out of business. And the City Council have basically come back to them after about 6 weeks to say, tough. No.
What happens if presumably they've thought about this as well, a sort of cabbie strike? They simply refuse to turn up at Temple Meads.
Well, this is one of the things that the cabbies did, is they all, when this was first announced the end of last year, it was about 40 or 50 cab drivers at Temple Meads all got these little letters that they got from First Group, and they burnt them together in a great big oil drum. Excellent. Outside Temple Meads, saying we're not paying this, you know. And but also the other thing is the deadline has been being put off and put off by First Group. First of all, they said it was going to be the 1st of February. No, none of the blue cabs are going to be able to apply for hire at Temple Meads. And now they're saying it's the 1st of March. You know, and this is what I've been getting, and I've seen copies of the letters from the cab drivers. But, I mean, it just shows what a racket transport is, you know, to me. It's appalling the way that the railway, privatised railway companies are now just looking to claw money from absolutely anyone they possibly can, with no thought to the justice of what they're doing.
Well, indeed. I mean, I suppose it's the profit motive, isn't it? And you can argue, and some people do, that, you know, privatisation, efficiency, blah, blah, blah. But the other side of the coin is that they're looking for every opportunity to make money. It's the same with car parking charges and the controversial withdrawal of buffet cars on some of the routes, because that obviously, you know.
Well, those horrible seats on the train now. I mean, you know, when I was first, this is a couple of years ago, they changed the seating arrangements, didn't they, on First Group. If you're going backwards and forwards to London now, you're sitting, even if the train is virtually empty, with about 6 inches in front of your face before you've got the seat in front of you.
Yeah, the airline style seating. But I mean, that's
just cramming them in, bums on seats.
It is cramming in,
it?
But actually, to be fair, that was happening. That started to happen under British Rail.
There was much more room on those trains before First Group took over, loads more room, and the seats were, you know, you had leg room and everything. I just find that the whole approach to sort of time and motion studies, super efficient, we've got to get more bums on seats, we've got to make more money for our shareholders, is the driving force. It's nothing to do anymore with actually what passengers want. We've also seen, of course, as you probably know, the shortening of trains on certain routes to the actual bare minimum. So, you know, particularly on commuter times, many people are using the trains, but they've not got a seat. Sometimes they can't even get on the train because the thing is so full. It's not actually about customer service anymore at all. You're called a customer, but you don't get any service.
No, exactly. I hate that as well.
So a lot of this goes back to beaching, which is and we've had several councillors and an MP on our programme recently on Fridays saying, oh, it's actually beaching is the real problem.
No, beaching was part of the problem. Of course, it wasn't beaching. He wasn't the bad guy. The bad guy was Marples, wasn't he?
Well, Ernest Marples and... I forgot his first name, actually. Mr. Beeching.
Mm. Richard
the pair
Beeching,
of
I think,
them,
wasn't
it? Yes, I think so. The pair, it was like a sort of double whammy, wasn't it? It was like a pincer movement, you know, one from the government direction, one from the private sector. Marples being the transport minister at the time, Conservative transport minister, who also just happened to be director of Marples Ridgeway, which who were the motorway building people. Now, for anyone that's driven to London recently, you will be probably cursing Marples Ridgeway for the Hammersmith flyover because it's gone down to one lane. Because, I mean, this is about 2 or 3 months ago. And funnily enough, I was chatting to the person that closed the Hammersmith flyover. It made the decision to close it.
Right.
And I think...
Am I right in thinking it was actually closed completely for a short while?
Yeah, completely.
Yeah, right.
Because they discovered that the thing wasn't safe. That it was,
right.
Yeah, I mean, basically what was happening was that the salt... from the salting of the road was leaching into the concrete and starting to corrode all the reinforcing
bars. Yeah, yeah.
And so, look, hang on a minute. This is they had done one or two tests where they found this was really serious. And you know, thankfully they closed it. I think it's actually quite a good testimony to the old-fashioned ways of doing things by the book and safely.
Yeah,
that they actually closed it because there's immense commercial pressure from people like Boris to keep it open. You know, we want our motorway open, and then they've sensibly reopened it with just allowing cars on there because, of course, it's the lorries that do a lot of the damage to the roads.
You're absolutely right. There is some shocking statistic about the proportion of damage because it's related to something like weight cubed. So your lorry does something like 10,000 or 100,000 times more damage than your average car. And actually, Tony's just looking up the relevant section in the book there to see if I'm right. Yeah, trust me, I'm right. I know I'm right on this.
You are right, yes. After two decades of prevarication, the Department of Transport grudgingly accepted that the tests carried out by the American Association of State Highway Officials in the late 50s said that they spent $27 million and reached the conclusion that damage caused to a road surface by a given vehicle axle was proportional to the weight of the axle to the power of 4. In other words, where it might be assumed that the wheels of a heavy lorry carrying 10 tonnes would cause 10 times as much damage as the wheels of a lighter vehicle bearing a tonne, the actual figure was 1,000 times greater.
So even that can't be right. It must be 10,000 times to the power of 4.
Yeah.
10 to the 4 is 10,000.
Well, maybe this guy's not so good on his maths.
That's right.
But it is, I mean, basically...
Either way, it's
every time we pay
our
car tax, we are massively subsidising
trucks,
lorries. And I imagine that you're one of these people that likes the idea of putting freight onto the railways.
Well, I'm very much in favour of putting freight on railways. And if I
was a lorry driver, I'd have it out with you now.
Well, you would, because what I'd like to do is put you driving a train instead, you know.
Yes, but how many lorries can you stick on the back of a train? About 50. So you're going to have 49 redundant lorry drivers.
You are, yeah. But that's, you know, that's all. It's all efficiency. I mean, what's the point of having people wasting their lives polluting the atmosphere when there's a better, faster, more...
But I haven't seen a train standing outside the Summerfield on Gloucester Road recently.
No, how
is that going to work?
Well, no, we certainly would still need road transport for very local deliveries. But the motorway stuff, that should all be, or most of it should be going motorway.
Well, that's what they used to do. I spoke to a chap, this is about 6 or 7 years ago, who used to, he was a Scottish farmer, and he used to move his pigs around the country by train. And I found that absolutely amazing, that he would just take a couple of pigs, and they had their own, British Rail had their own sort of pig
wagon,
carton,
yeah,
which you put these two pigs in, and it even had a little thing to feed them for 24 hours or whatever.
Wow.
And then the next day, those pigs would be delivered to a farm down in Kent somewhere.
Right.
You know, so it would go... they had all sorts of different priorities for the different types of things that they were carrying around up until beaching. And also, the other thing is, every station had its own little place that you could put a wagon, you know. So there was even if it was only a tiny little siding or something, you could pretty much deliver freight to anywhere. And there were freight hubs all around the country. So everything did go by rail.
Yeah.
And people just got used to expecting to, if they wanted to pick something up, rather than drive halfway across the country and back again, they would just drive to their local freight terminal and pick it up there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm pleased to be able to say that generally freight on rail is booming. You know, there's,
is it?
Yeah. It's a growth industry. There's for instance,
well, lorries are booming too, aren't they?
Well, more lorries not so much. All the time. Well, I mean, because we've seen recently that actually just this week, the price of crude oil in pounds is more expensive than it's ever been.
Well, there's another racket for
you. Well, no, I disagree. Well, it isn't.
You think that there's a real market in the oil price?
I think generally it is driven by basic supply
and
demand.
It costs something like $3 to get it out of the ground. So why are we paying $100 and something?
No, it costs quite a lot more than that.
No, it doesn't.
It does. It's about $20.
I mean, to get it out of the ground. It's about $3. I'll tell you that from my researches.
I believe it's more than that. I mean, but the point
is... Of course, the oil business is going to say it costs them more. They always do.
But they'll also say that there's tons of oil in the ground, and there isn't. But the point is, the only credible explanation for why oil production has remained pretty much static for the last 7 years, and why the price of oil keeps going up and up and up, it's basic supply and demand economics, isn't it? That we've reached peak oil, we can't get any more out of the ground any quicker. Many of the oil fields in the world...
I know why they call you Steve Satan now.
many of the oil fields, particularly the North Sea and all the oil fields in the US and so on, they're declining at about 5% a year.
Well, there is another view, you know, which is that there's loads of oil there. It's just that the reserves are all in the knowledge of the oil companies. They all keep it very, very quiet about where the reserves are and how much they've got. We had one of the directors of Shell a couple of years ago was sacked because he'd clearly been falsifying the oil reserves, because I mean it's a very expensive business, all the seismological work that goes into figuring out where the oil reserves are. There is another view, which is that they're just racking up the oil price because they can, because whereas there's a cartel involved.
I mean, I think there is a cartel. It's called OPEC. But the point is,
no, it's Shell, it's ExxonMobil. These are the real players in the cartel. These are the people that do most of the refining and most of the distribution. I mean, if you go back to... I mean, this has a direct connection, in a way, back to public transport, where in the United States, back in the 1940s and 50s, the oil companies, particularly ExxonMobil, at the time they were just called Exxon, because they hadn't merged again with Mobil at that point, they got together with General Motors, Mack Truck Company, Firestone Tire and Rubber Company, and they set up secretly, so nobody knew this company was controlled by these big boys, a company called National City Lines, which slowly started buying up the various public transport networks around the United States and then running them into the ground.
Yeah, now that is absolutely true.
To make money, just all to make money. So more people had to buy cars, more people had to buy more fuel, because everybody had to have their own engine because there wasn't something to take you around anymore. And obviously more tyres needed to be bought. So there's a big commercial incentive in the oil companies talking about, oh, it's terrible, isn't it? Dreadful how we haven't got any oil left and we're going to have to charge double now.
Well, the thing about that, though, Tony, that only works if you tie up all the production. If there's a big oil producer who's not part of the cartel with spare capacity, then your price rigging kind of doesn't work.
Well,
does it
does, in a way, because you try and rig the price, and then what happens is the people who are outside that are quite happy for the price to be going up because they're getting loads more money out of it. So in a way, you're leading the market in a certain direction, and the other guys on the periphery of your cartel will follow because they're making more money out of it. The problem is when the price starts going down. That's when the people will start thinking, well, actually, we don't necessarily like this. There's a whole world out there which is hardly ever touched on by the mainstream media of how the oil prices are set.
Well, course, yeah, but I mean, that particular conspiracy theory, I don't just buy into it. Let me put it to you in very general terms. We do know that oil is a finite resource, isn't it? So at some point, it's going to start running out. And, you know, conspiracy, even without a conspiracy, what happens when the oil starts to run out is that the oil price will go through the roof. And I put it to you that is what we are experiencing.
Yes,
now.
It could be. Yes, what I'm saying is there is another view. And I think we haven't actually ever seen, I mean, I've never seen any proper debate and discussion about this topic to actually try and get to the truth. Because I think there is a truth, one way or another. The thing that bothers me is that the oil companies are all very, very secretive. A little bit like the Knights Templar from Bristol knowing about the existence of America before it was ever admitted to the public. There's a lot of knowledge in the oil industry which, I think is being kept from the public for commercial reasons.
Well,
which is a good reason to nationalise it.
Well, possibly,
and
but
then
no,
you can start
on, but
setting the price of the oil, so no, we don't have to keep the price. Doesn't it? You know, we have these wars in the Middle East, don't we? And we're told that this is all, you know, about oil, or at least a lot of people say that. And you would expect that the oil price would be steady or falling because of what's been going on in Iraq and places like that. But no, it just keeps creeping up and up. So maybe you're right, but maybe there is a. I mean, there certainly is a cartel. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
But I mean, I think even privatising it wouldn't work because many of the oil companies are state owned anyway.
And who?
Well, Statoil, the Norwegian one, the Saudi Arabian one is state-owned.
Almost all of them are private commercial businesses. All the people who the big players in the oil industry are private companies.
Well, but I mean, you know, you have
ExxonMobil, Shell, BP. They're all private.
They're all private. That's true. and I've forgotten where I was going with this, actually. So let's.
I just stump you?
You destroyed my train of thought. I was coming on to something really brilliant. You brought a book with us. Just tell us briefly about the book and who it's by.
This is a book called The Great Railway Conspiracy. Obviously, this is something I'm going to love. It's by David Henshaw.
Can I borrow it when you're done?
David Henshaw. Well, I tell you what, maybe I can get you a copy. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
It's about £4 secondhand on if you get it online.
Oh right. Okay.
David Henshaw, who actually lives in the middle of Somerset near Yeovil somewhere, is just down the road from here, and he says here the Great Railway Conspiracy author lifts lid on deals that ditched the trains, and what he's done is he's taken us right through from does a bit about the whole all the beaching years and the 1960s and the way that beaching from ICI came in, you know. Parachuted into the British Rail, as it was at the time. I think it was called the British Transport Commission. After the Second World War, is they decided actually transport is in danger of falling into becoming a racket, as of course it has now. and so what we need some sort of sensible people appointed by the government to make sure that transport works properly and it doesn't cost the earth, and that people are able to get around the country at cost. You know, this is the whole point of it, is that you don't want shareholders taking profits out of the system. You don't want fat cat bosses running the, also taking massive, £100,000 salaries out of the system. You want a system which works for the people that use it, which means that it should be run at cost. You know, so that's what essentially the British Transport Commission were doing. And beaching came in during those days and was told, actually, what we need to do is to rack back the railways. And the reason that happened was because there was a general election in 1955 and a two-week train strike just before the general election.
Right.
Which meant, I mean, this is all over, apparently, the price of a packet of fags for a week's wages for the train drivers and people working on the railways.
Right.
But the government refused to budge. No, we're not going to give you that extra bit of money, which is the price of a packet of fags. And so the whole country went on strike. There was no trains for like 2 weeks. And there were some amazing pictures for the Whitsun Bank holiday that year at Clapham Junction, which was normally the busiest day of the year. They had all sorts of specials that used to run from London down to the south coast and everything. And on the front of the Union's magazine, special edition for the strike, there's this massive picture of Clapham Junction with nothing happening at all on Whitsun.
But you wonder how they managed to distribute the magazine with all the...
Members, but anyway,
but the mail ran by trains in those days.
Well, yes, it may have taken a little bit longer to get through. So so that was the reason why. Okay, that was the reason why. I think that the beaching thing was brought in to beat the unions on the railways.
Transport economics conspiracy theories. You love your conspiracy theories, don't you?
I do actually. Yeah, I find them absolutely riveting. There's a guy called David Southwell who's written a book called Secrets and Lies, which goes through so many of the most really irritating conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to know one from the other as whether it's true, is it rubbish?
Yeah, yeah.
But his is like a sort of conspiracy theorist Bible, Secrets and Lies, and it goes through every area you could imagine, UFOs, goodness knows, JFK.
Yeah.
And what he does, I think, is brilliant, which is to actually drill into each one and give you some really good stuff to go on if you wanted to know about whether this is true or complete rubbish. Because, of course, there's a massive industry of disinformation out there. which is pushing nonsense out to the public, the idea being to just obscure the truth for whatever reason. I mean, it's psychological warfare.
Well, I think even that in itself is a conspiracy theory, that it's some big conspiracy to obscure the truth. But it's actually human nature just to sort of tell tales.
It's not that. The companies that do it, are these big strategic communications firms, are hardly known about by the public. We had a brief blip, didn't we, before Christmas about a story The Independent did about Bell Pottinger, this company which had been fixing various entries on WikiLeaks for people for six-figure sums. You know, say, for example, the Steve Satan Wikipedia page had some nasty stuff about you being involved in a black mass, and you decided, I don't want that on my Wikipedia page. Then you would pay Bell Pottinger a six-figure sum, and you'd find the next day it would all have disappeared.
All fluffy, and
everything would be gorgeous. This is a fantastic man, etc. But these strategic communication firms are massive, it's a multi-billion pound industry or dollar industry around the world. And the other thing about strategic communications is people don't know who's actually paying for it. Sometimes it's the Chinese government. Right. You know, it could be the US government. It could be a big military conglomerate of some sort that's paying for a particular spin to go on an election in the run-up to an election over the 3 years before an election to get a particular person elected. But it's an industry which is very little known about. So that Bell Pottinger story, in a way, it really is a tip of an iceberg of disinformation.
Right. Let me just go back to one thing we were talking about earlier about peak oil. There is this theory that let me put this one to you. See if this one works. That basically, the governments, they know about peak oil. They know it's very bad news, and they know that we're in deep doo doo. But any politician with bad news just doesn't get re-elected. So it's actually in the politician's interest to try and gloss it over and pretend that everything's all right and pursue business as usual.
No, I think you're absolutely right. The politicians have become like marketing people, really, for big business. It seems that they're a sort of front operation. They're right. The front of house. You go into the back. It's like the man from Uncle. You remember that? From the 60s,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, I don't remember.
What happened to the man from Uncle is you go into a tailor's shop, and then you go in to sort of try something on in the changing booth, and the whole thing turns around, and you're then in the Uncle headquarters, where all the spies are. But I mean, that's the way I see politics nowadays. Certainly the government, the cabinet, they are there to sort of sell ideas and sell, the plans of big business to us. Yeah. Unfortunately, the real MPs, who are usually backbenchers and get a chance maybe to put some important points at question time, like Michael Meacher the other day pointed out that if we took off the richest 2,000 people in Britain, the extra money they've made, not their money they've made, but the extra money they've made over the last 2 years, we could pay off the deficit.
Is that right?
Yeah. Now, little things like that, and you think, well, why isn't this guy running things? Because Meacher really does seem to be a bit of a radical, and he's saying, well, look, we don't need a financial crisis if you just take off the rich the extra money they've made over the last couple of years.
Right.
So getting back to the peak oil thing, I actually hold various different positions all at the same time. I haven't made my mind up one way or another. I'm not like an advocate for one position or another, but I do agree it's quite feasible that we are really running out of oil, and that's why the reason the price is going up. But I think at the same time, I also think it's quite feasible that this is the cartel artificially keeping the prices high. I think that there are, it's actually not, there's no real conclusion over that one yet.
Okay, well, let's talk about High Speed 2. Where do you stand on that?
Well, first of all, tell me a bit about it, because I'm not massively familiar with it. Okay, I'll tell you what I know, which is that it's a massively faster increased train technology, and as I understand it, the line they're planning is from London to Birmingham, and it's going to take how much off the journey time?
Probably about 50 minutes. It's not quite halving it.
Or 15?
No, 50, I think. It's quite a lot. Yeah, I think it's...
How fast do these things go?
They're proposed to run at 225 miles an hour with a possible increase to 250. They're designing the line so it can handle 250 miles an hour in the future.
Right.
Which seems quite sensible. But we should be running a maglev instead, you reckon?
I think so, yeah. I'd like to see some of this technology rolled out. I mean, there are isn't it the Japanese that use it?
No, it's Chinese.
Chinese, that's right.
Well, in fact, you know, it was a British invention. But the problem with maglev is this.
Should we just explain maglev?
Okay, this means
magnetic levitation rail.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So you have all these kind of very complicated electromagnets in the track, which raise by magnetic force this this train off the track, so it's actually not touching the track, and they also propel it forward as well.
Doesn't sound very good for slowing down. It might.
It can work quite well in reverse. You know, it's like running an electric motor backwards. You know,
So there's
no physical braking. Yeah, it's all done electronically.
When it comes to a station, it's sort of the magnetism
reverses.
And the thing then sits on the rail.
No, it stays levitated.
Does it?
Yeah, but it gets reversed, so it's getting slowed down.
So you reckon the Chinese have been sold a pup with this technology?
No. I think.
Well, why can't we have it then?
We can have it. We have had it. There was a very slow demonstration at Birmingham Airport a few years ago. Or was it the NEC? Somewhere in Birmingham. And then they gave up on it. Okay. The problem with maglev is this. Okay, it is hideously expensive because the track, rather than just being two metal rails, has to consist of a whole load of electromagnets and a whole load of electronics and a whole load of power stations to run it as well. It works, but it's very expensive. The other interesting thing is that the fastest maglev train in the world is only about 1% faster than the fastest conventional train. So you're wondering, what's the advantage of this super technology?
Well, you've convinced me. Sounds like an absolute waste of money.
Well, I'll give you one other problem with it as well. And if, let's suppose we had a maglev train running from London to Birmingham, what happens when you get to Birmingham? You have to get off the train and transfer to a conventional train to go any further. Whereas with high-speed trains, they can continue on existing lines. They're integrated, or they can be integrated. And that's why, you know, I think the future is with conventional rail technology. And that's why, you know, the Europeans are doing
it. What about this whole obsession with going faster and faster all the time everywhere?
Well, I think people like to get places faster, don't they? That's only natural. You know, if you want to spend, you know, 2 hours in the car,
enjoy the journey. Can't you just sort of take a break and read a book, or
Some extent you can, but people still would rather. You know, you don't really want to spend 5 hours on a plane going to New York, do you? You'd rather be there in two, and that's why people chose Concorde if they could afford it, and so on. I think the thing about high speed too is not. The main reason why I think we need it is not to shave a few minutes off the journey time to Birmingham, because clearly that by itself wouldn't justify it. And that's actually, I think, one of the mistakes that people make. They say, well, you know, why are we spending all this money to get people to Birmingham a bit quicker? And that's not why we're doing it, and that wouldn't be a case for doing it. The reason we're doing it is because we need the extra capacity, where you've got a situation where the existing West Coast Main Line is basically full, and we talked about freight earlier on, didn't we? And you know, there's suppressed demand. There's people who want to run their freight trains on the West Coast Main Line. They just can't find a slot. You know, it's full. So by building a new line,
what about night time?
I'm sure that it's fully freighted up at night time, but I don't believe it. Well, it's not quite as simple as that. I mean,
you can have a train every 10 minutes all through the night. I don't believe that there's that much need there's that much desperate, you know, traffic on the line.
I believe that there isn't.
Isn't it twin track? It must be.
It's quadrupled. Yeah, so two
quadruple track.
Yeah.
Right. So this must be plenty of capacity.
There isn't. No, there isn't.
Maybe they just don't want to pay the signalman at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Double
wages.
You've got to also take into account, you know, the connections and what happens at each end and so on. But no, freight is booming. So I believe that. So if you want to increase capacity, you've got to build a new railway. And if you're going to build a new railway, you might as well make it high speed, because, you know.
So you think it's more important to spend money on building a super high speed rail that takes 50 minutes off the journey time to Birmingham?
I've already explained
from
why that's
London,
not the reason.
Rather than to build housing, for example.
That's a debate you can have about your priorities for the nation.
Well, that's
as a
what
whole.
I'm having with you now. Yeah.
Well,
you think it's more important to build a super high speed train than to build housing?
Yeah, actually, I do. Yeah,
no,
yeah.
Yeah,
I do.
No,
yeah,
no,
I do. Yeah,
no.
I do. Yeah.
Look, there are all sorts of vested interests that want this high-speed train built, no doubt. High-tech companies, you know, continental firms who want to see their technology employed and used. The other thing, of course, there'll be massive maintenance contracts for all of this stuff way into the future if and when it doesn't actually do the job it's supposed to do. The other thing is it's destroying loads of countryside. We don't need to destroy. Let's keep on the existing lines and, as you say, use existing, you know, train networks, get people around quicker. Surely these trains can go along the existing line if that existing line from London to Birmingham is upgraded.
Well, we've tried that, and the problem is when you have an existing line, it becomes progressively harder and harder to sort of tweak it and improve it to the point, I don't know, it becomes just not worth it anymore. We did it recently.
People want to get to Birmingham quick. Surely they could just fly. London City Airport or
No,
this
is the whole thing. When you factor in the customs, the baggage, the waiting, you know, all that nonsense.
You don't need customs and all that sort of stuff for an internal the UK.
Well, like I say,
domestic flights, don't have that.
I don't think there is anyone flying from London to Birmingham. And
from London City Airport to Birmingham, I almost guarantee you. Go online, let's check it out.
Okay, I will do that. But the point is, because the airports tend to be out of town, rail transport, even though the train itself is a lot slower than the aeroplane, it still works out a lot quicker on distances up to about 200, 300 miles.
So how much is this costing, this HS2
thing? I think it's 17 billion or something like that.
17
it's a lot of money.
Billion. But 17 billion? How many houses could you build for that, for goodness sake?
I expect. Well, 17,000. 170,000. The point is, I actually agree with you about this countryside issue, you know, slicing through the Chilterns. It's totally unjustified because of the super high speed aspect that for some reason, and they haven't explained or justified it, they've chosen this speed, which is a lot higher than the speed of high speed trains in Europe. They want to go at 225 miles an hour, where most of them go at 186 miles an hour. And the difference in that speed is quite a lot in terms of energy consumption. So there's a huge penalty at going above 200 miles an hour. So these trains are going to, you know, use up loads of fuel, whatever that fuel comes from. It could be, you know, green, it could be nuclear, it could be coal, whatever. It's electric. So what I would argue is that we need to go just a little bit slower, adopt the same speed as, you know, the European trains. And then if we do that, we can follow existing transport corridors. We can follow the M1 and M6 to get to Birmingham. And, you know, anyone living next to the M1 is not going to be particularly upset if, you know, a little bit more of that M1 embankment is trashed and they have to have their house demolished and get compensated to move further away from the motorway. I'm sure they'd be very happy about that, you know. So you wouldn't have this Chilterns controversy.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. But what's going on with the Eurostar, you know, the train that goes over to Paris? Is that actually now going to be able to come into London, through London and out up to Birmingham, up this super line?
Possibly.
At some mega speed? Well, or is there any kind of integration with that at all?
Possibly is the answer.
It'd be quite nice to hop on a train at Templemeads and get off in ultimately, I mean, okay, this is to Birmingham.
I totally agree. But the thing is that the problem is that there actually isn't that much traffic. Now, on the face of it seems perfectly sensible to say, well, yeah, the high-speed train should go straight through the Channel Tunnel. But the number of passengers who would want to go from Birmingham to Paris probably doesn't justify the direct services.
But you see, the thing is, people round Birmingham and north of Birmingham would go to Birmingham to get that train to Paris, wouldn't they?
Possibly not enough.
If Beeching hadn't trashed most of our railway lines that feed into the network, which brings us back to talking about why Beeching happened in the first place and the unions, because that was what we were talking about before the news, I think is a key point, is that actually the idea of unionising cars, you know, the idea that you can't actually unionise a car was a key motivating force in Beeching closing down most of the railway network because of this strike just before the general election. This was immediately what the Conservative government that got in 1955 embarked on, a plan to pare down the railways, pare down the power of the unions. And that is why we're in the situation of virtual gridlock, you know, quite often in the city here and in other, you know, important places around the world, particularly in London. They absolutely have to rely on public transport. And let's not forget what Ken Livingstone did in the 1980s. I'm sure you know all about that.
Fair.
London. I mean, he actually got elected as the Mayor of London on a platform of reducing transport fares. Now, imagine if our so-called mayor, which apparently we may have to have here in Bristol, gets elected on a platform of reducing first buses, transport fares, even though he can't necessarily do it. I mean, the thing is, in London and in that time, the politicians did have control of public transport, even though the central government wouldn't let them actually invest in the undergrounds and in the buses. One thing they could do was reduce the fares, and they found in London, bizarrely and counterintuitively maybe, that after 2 years of cutting the fares on public transport in London, they actually have more money in revenue. And that's what I think we should be doing in the city. We see far more people using public transport if we had a cut in fares. First Bus and their shareholders were out of the way. And we'd also see less accidents and less people tearing their hair out trying to get home at half past five in the evenings.
Tony Gosling for mayor. Tony, we'll have to leave it there, I'm afraid. But
before we go, I've got one little thing to say about yesterday afternoon. I was down in Somerset Levels. Before the beginning of March, get down to the Levels. This is just, it's a place called Ham Wall. It's a nature reserve. And the starling murmuration there, and it's one of these things.
Is that the official word, murmuration?
The murmuration, which is when all the starlings come together to roost in the evening, and they do it. Do you know why they do it? Have you ever seen them up in the sky? These kind of weird swirling patterns. They've got 3.5 million starlings down at the moment. Wow. Down at
and
the
you counted
levels.
Everyone. No, it's basically they're just getting their act together for preparing for what do you call it?
Going to bed.
Going to bed. No. Migration, that's the word I'm struggling to find.
No, it's nothing to do with migration, because they do it right throughout. The starlings are here from October to March, basically.
Right.
The massive numbers of them. There's still a few remain here after, but they mostly go back mid-March. They go back to Russia and Scandinavia, where they spend most of the year.
Okay.
But these murmurations are because they're basically to stop predators. Because at that time of the evening, a lot of the raptors, the hawks, the peregrines, these kind of birds are out there to eat a starling for supper.
Right.
And so they get together, and they've realised, they've sussed out that if they all stick together through the night, the chances are they'll survive the night. Whereas if they're all scattered around, they don't. So they get together in these massive clouds. And I can tell you, it's an incredible sight. You have to keep your hat on, because if the thing goes right over the top of you, these birds are dropping their droppings on your head.
Lovely.
But when you have 3.5 million starlings going over you at about 40 miles an hour, it's quite, I mean, literally just above your head, it's pretty spectacular.
Right.
And they will be there, this is just northwest of Glastonbury at Hamwall RSPB Reserve, till the middle of March. So get down there about an hour before dusk, and they quite often do, the RSPB do talks and sort of guided explanations, so you can ask any questions about it. And that is an absolute must. If you've never been near one of the biggest murmurations in the country, get down there.
Okay, I will do. Thanks, Tony.